This is a CBC podcast.
Smart Shift Applies, the conversations of Mansbridge one-on-one. Dr. Mark Tremblay.
The health burden of obesity has now exceeded that of smoking.
Join the conversation at cbc.ca/smartshift. Smart Shift, presented by IBM.
Hi, this is the North by Northwest podcast featuring the Studio One Book Club with author Judy Fong Bates. Judy Fong Bates is the author of a collection of short stories, China Dog and other stories, her acclaimed novel, Midnight at the Dragon Cafe, and most recently, a memoir, The Year of Finding Memory. It's a story about her family who came from China, the hardships they encountered in Canada, and a lot of the questions that Judy Fong Bates was left with as a daughter of immigrants, and how she went back to China and solved some of the mysteries that had always been a curiosity and sometimes a pain to her about her parents' lives. Judy Fong Bates in the Studio One Book Club, and co-host for this book club is author Nancy Lee. You took a shortcut. Judy, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
So we always start with the book club with a bit of a reading. So where would you like to begin with that?
Well, I have chosen a section early in the book, and I chose the section because it's the day that my father arrives in Vancouver, his absolutely first day, April 6th, 1914. And since I love Vancouver so much, I thought it might be a good place to start. On April 6th, 1914, the day my father and his older brother arrived in Canada, a Vancouver newspaper, the Daily News Advertiser, forecast fair and warm weather. Further down the front page, the mayor of Vancouver expressed concern about the large number of Chinese who were entering the country. He emphasized the uncontrollable temper of Orientals, proof of their unpredictability, making them unsuitable candidates for immigration. On the same day, the Vancouver Daily World carried a story from a canning mill about a Chinese worker who, after being criticized by his white foreman, picked up his superior and, in a fit of rage, tried to throw him into a boiling cauldron. However, the Chinaman, or Celestial as he was called, was restrained and disaster was averted. Compared to the white Canadians, my father and the Chinese men of his generation were small. When I discovered these stories in the Vancouver newspaper archives, it was hard for me to reconcile this portrait of a violent, impulsive Chinese man with my docile father and others like him whom I had seen over the years whenever I visited Chinatown in Toronto. I distinctly recall from my early childhood one particular customer who came into my father's hand laundry, a giant red-faced man who stomped through the door, stood in front of the wooden counter, and banged its surface with a clenched fist until my father appeared. Waving his hand dismissively, the man leaned against the counter and boomed, I know, no ticky, no laundry. You fine, Charlie, you fine. My father untied and folded back the brown paper from package after package of cleaned and pressed garments until the man recognized his clothes. He never apologized for the extra work he put my father through, and my father never protested. Instead, he nodded his head up and down, a stiff smile plastered across his face. I peeked from behind the curtain that hung over the doorway, separating the service from the washing areas. Blood rushed to my cheeks. But the next time this man came into our laundry with his sack of dirty clothes, my father wrote a name in Chinese characters on each half of the ticket before giving the man's portion to him. When the man returned for his finished laundry a few days later, again, without his half of the slip, my father had to unwrap only one package. The man was speechless and managed to mutter no more than thank you as he left the laundry. My father later told me that he'd written the man's name on his half of the ticket. But he doesn't have a Chinese name, I said. Oh, yes, he does, said my father. His name is Mo No Suk, No Brain Uncle. I wrote it on his ticket and inside the collars of his shirts. My father may have loathed the lowly position that he occupied in the small towns where we lived, but he never forgot it. He was meek and fearful of authority. Any anger he felt about the treatment he received from his customers and townsfolk, he kept to himself. The closest he came to an act of defiance was to bestow an unflattering name in a foreign language, which he would then inscribe in black ink with a fine nib pen inside their clothes. The notion that someone like my tiny father could so much as threaten, let alone attack a lofon, a Westerner, and lift him off the ground is so preposterous, the thought of it is almost funny. But there was, in fact, nothing funny about the way that people like my father were perceived by the lofons of that time. The Chinese were considered to be undesirable, perhaps even subhuman. When I researched the records from the ship that brought my father to Vancouver, I found that passengers who were of European descent had specific destinations, cities like Calgary, Regina, Winnipeg, Toronto, Montreal. They were recognized as individuals and as Anglican, Presbyterian, Baptist, Roman Catholic. But the Chinese passengers were a monolithic yellow horde. Every one of them was listed as a Buddhist. And regardless of where the Chinaman stepped off the train, as far as these records were concerned, he was going to Montreal, Montreal being the train's final stop.
Judy, I love in that excerpt how it captures your father's ingenuity in the face of the hardships he had to endure when he first came to Canada. The book opens with the death of your father and your discovery amongst his papers of his head tax certificate. And we find out that a lot of your family's life here in Canada was really shaped by Canadian immigration law. I wonder if you could tell us a bit about how the country's immigration law sort of had an impact on your family.
The Exclusion Act of 1923 kept the Chinese out of Canada, or most Chinese out of Canada, with a few exceptions, and I'm not sure exactly who the exceptions were according to the immigration laws of the time, but I do know that our former Governor General managed to get in 1939, and I think she must have had special dispensation, because most of the Chinese were prevented from coming into Canada after 1923, and the laws weren't repealed until, I think, about 1947, you know, after the war. But my father went back to China back and forth several times, and he had a family there. And most of his children, I think, were born in the 30s. And I've always felt that were it not for that Exclusion Act, he would have probably brought his children over, and he might have even brought his first wife over, in which case he would have established a family here, and he wouldn't have had this divided life. I don't think that was just true of my father. I think that was probably true of a lot of Chinese men.
And because of the immigration law, then he ended up bringing his second wife here along with you. So, I mean,
that's right.
In a way, you were here by virtue of the
exactly.
rules of the government.
Yes.
Can you tell us a bit about what daily life was like for your father when he came to Canada to find this better life?
I probably don't know exactly what it was like because I didn't know him then, but I suspect that it probably wasn't all that different from the life that I witnessed. I have a hunch that it was probably much harsher because it was so early in the 20th century. I think that the racism that he would have suffered then was something probably much more harsh than anything I had to deal with as a child growing up in a small town. I think that running a hand laundry, and my father was not an innovative person. When I look back on my childhood, I really think that I lived the kind of childhood that probably somebody a lot older than I am would have lived, because he was operating a laundry the way that it was operated probably even in the 1920s. And he was operating that laundry right into the mid-60s. And it was a very, very monotonous life.
And so he was hand-sorting, hand-washing.
Hand-sorting. It wasn't completely hand-washing. There was some mechanism. There was, as I describe in the book, what there was in what would have been the parlor of this house. There was a huge machine that was shaped like a barrel on its horizontal axis, and it was held up by four metal legs, and it stood inside a metal pan, and he would stuff it full of clothes, and then he'd turn on a motor, and this machine would rotate back and forth in one direction and then in the opposite direction, churning clothes much the way that a washing machine does today. But that's all it did. And then he would have to open a door or a hatch, and he'd have to pull the clothes out item by item, and he'd have to put them through a ringer, mm-hmm. and then the clothes would be caught on the other side of a ringer in a huge bamboo basket. And then he'd have to take those clothes and he'd put them into tubs of clear water, and he would rinse them in tub after tub until the clothes were clear, and then he'd put them through a hand wringer again, and again they would be caught by a laundry basket. And as I talk and as I mentioned in the book, in the warm weather, when the weather was fine, they would be hung on lines outside to dry. But when the weather was cold or inclement, we had a room at the back of the house, and it would be strung with lines, with wire lines, about maybe 2 feet down from the ceiling. And he would peg all those clothes on those lines, and he would heat up a cast iron stove, and he would heat the room to about 80, 85 degrees, and that's how the clothes were dried. And at the end of the day, he would take down the clothes, and then he would iron every single item by hand, except for the sheets. The sheets, now this is the part I don't mention in the book, but we had a huge roller that operated kind of like an iron, and he would feed it between two rollers that spun, and he would feed the tea towels and the sheets and the pillowcases through, and it would come through the bottom, and then he'd have to fold them by hand.
The labor. The labor
it was intense, very intense, and it was endless. And I remember my father, on ironing days, he would often start at about 7 in the morning, and he wouldn't finish till midnight.
It's incomprehensible, isn't it?
It is, truly.
Judy, what led you to revisit this story, to write this memoir? What got that started?
I think it's a book that I had intended to write for a very long time. But I think the roadblock was always my father's suicide. Within Chinese culture, it's particularly heavy. There is a very heavy mantle of shame. And I think it has to do with a general preoccupation with perfection and with having to present this perfect veneer to the outside world. And I often think of how that was played out with the Olympics in Beijing, that lovely little girl who sang the national anthem and who looked so perfect. And then we found out that the real singer was a girl who was not allowed to present herself, but actually sang the song, and the song was taped, and the perfect-looking child mouthed the words.
And so with this, with the memoir, then, what was it that finally got you to the point where you would go past that roadblock, as you described, of your father's
time.
Suicide?
I think time had something to do with it. I'd had enough distance. I think it also had something to do with my agent. She and I were talking, and I had told her the story of my family, but I hadn't told her about my father's suicide. And she had already felt that from events that I told her about my mother's life, and because my mother did have a very vivid beginning, she'd really felt that this would make a great story. And we had actually pitched it to several publishers, and then we were talking one day. It must have been time for me to deal with this, and I blurted out to her that my father had committed suicide, and she just about fell off her chair. Mm. And of course, she said, well, you can't write this story without including that. Mm. And I realized that she was right. And also, at that point, I had planned a trip to China, and then, of course, when I went to China, I found out things that initially really bothered me because they didn't match what I knew about my parents, and I really felt that these people had mythologized them in a way that I just felt wasn't paying proper tribute to them. But nevertheless, all those things that I was told, it just stuck in the back of my head and I couldn't shake it off. And so it meant another trip back to China. And then I think with the two trips, I finally had a portal through which I could enter this story.
One of the underlying tensions in the book, the tension between what your relatives in China feel about your parents' life, that it was full of success and happiness and wealth, and then the reality of what your parents' life looked to you, which is full of sacrifice and suffering and pain and unhappiness. How did you sort of deal with that when you were in China facing the relatives? Was there a part of you that wanted to kind of set them straight and say, no, my parents' life wasn't like that at all? Or was there a part of you that wanted to preserve their impression of what life was like for your parents here?
Oh, I think I struggled with that because certainly there were times when I wanted to say to my sister, you know, in Canada, our father was not a powerful man, because in China, just about everybody I met referred to my father as Mangkala, which is a Chinese word meaning powerful. And in Canada, he was not powerful, and they revered him, it seemed. And there was very much a part of me that wanted to set that record straight. And I think that there were a number of emotions going on, and I can't say that it was because I wanted to protect them, to preserve that reputation for my parents. I mean, that might have been part of it, but I think a large part of it was that I still felt that sense of shame. I couldn't get past that. And so I was never able to really tell my sister in China what had really happened.
But did you find how they thought of your parents, did you find that changed the way that you thought of your parents? Did it enable you to look at them in a different way?
Oh, certainly. I did find myself looking at my parents in a different way. And the very strange thing about that, and this was a sensation that I was really not prepared for, and that was that as I got to know my parents more in China, as they became more fleshed out for me, they became so disconnected from the people I knew in Canada that they actually turned into strangers. And they grew further and further apart. And so there was that sense of gain and loss all at the same time, because they were no longer the people I knew. So it was a very odd feeling for me, whereas I think that for some people, that finding out more about their parents will augment what they already know, and it makes them feel closer. And so I had a very strange outcome in a way.
What does that leave you with now when you think about your family and your parents and their relationship?
It leaves me with a certain sense of satisfaction that their story has been told, but it also leaves me with a great sense of sadness, because my parents were also on the cusp, just on the absolute cusp of happiness. And they truly were victims of history. Because I think when my father returned to China after the war, I think he was really hoping for a Kuomintang victory. And he and my mother were managing a store in the market town very close to our village. And I remember, and I talk about it in the book on this second journey, when I walk up the stairs and I visit the apartment that my parents had shared, I could have wept, because I was expecting something that reflected the life that I had shared with them, some dark, cramped quarter. But instead, I walked up this wide staircase with these beautiful spindles and this very tall ceiling and a roof that met in a perfect peak in the center. And it had windows on both ends, and it had light pouring in. And when I went into the kitchen, even though it was a kitchen that was still using solid fuel, the light that was in there was like something out of Vermeer. And I remember that it just didn't match at all the people I knew, and I wanted to weep, because I really felt that this was a place of possibilities that were never met.
And politics was the reason, really.
Absolutely.
Hi, what's your name?
My name is Eva. First, I'd like to thank you for sharing your life story. I don't have a chance to read your book yet, and I'm looking forward to reading it. I came here exactly 60 years after your father. I came here 74 as, visible Chinese, and I was kind of surprised by the reception of Chinese, local Chinese. What I felt was, they were quite distant, and we weren't welcome. As a matter of fact, one of my colleagues who was local Chinese, he was brought up in Chinatown. He was a wonderful person, but somehow I felt, there was something not right. And he said that, well, you guys have it good. While we were growing up, we can do this, we can do that. When we go to a movie house, we have to sit in the back rows of cinema. And so I was just wondering, coming from a small place, do you have the same feeling towards Chinese that came after the 60s when the discrimination is not as overt and apparent, and people are supposed to be respectful, multicultural, and you say that, all this time we suffer and you guys come and you get, all the support and everything?
Oh, that's a big question. I think that because I grew up in a small town, I was really kind of outside of that. And so in some ways, you're probably asking the wrong person, because I didn't grow up in a Chinese community. I really am someone who is a hybrid within a hybrid. I grew up really in a situation where I was, for most of my childhood, the only Chinese child in the town and the only non-white child in the town. And so I never really kind of looked upon other Chinese people even as my peers, because all my references were white. My sense of beauty and sexuality and all those kinds of things were in fact white, because I remember as a kid kind of thinking, wouldn't I give to look like Sandra Dee? She's blonde and she has blue eyes. And so, it was kind of a impossibility.
Well, one of the things you do talk about in the book is how your father sort of made the mistake of moving to the small towns instead of, say, going to Toronto, where there was a Chinese community, and how desperate especially your mother was for some kind of community, some kind of connection with other Chinese Canadians.
Oh, that's very true. I think when I look back on it that we really should have looked for a laundry in a city like Toronto, where there would have been some kind of community, especially for someone like my mother. Because I think that for women, that sense of sisterhood is really, really important. And my mother had been someone who had been looked up to in our village because she had education, and she was the one who would write letters for people, and people would bring her, things to read, and she would explain things to other people. And suddenly she was in this small town where she had no status, she couldn't speak the language. A part of the foundation of this story that is Canada, and that their story isn't a story that just belongs to me or to the Chinese community, but is in fact a story that belongs to Canada.
Hi there, what's your name?
Patricia Holm. I haven't read your new book yet. You were just mentioning the difference in their lifestyle in China and here, or as you perceived it to be. Considering his outcome, do you think he made the right choice leaving China?
Oh, that's a really, really tough question. For me, yes, he made the right choice. For him, I don't know. I really honestly don't know. But on the other hand, if he had stayed in China and with the communists, he would have suffered terribly with the Cultural Revolution and all that. I'm not sure that my parents would have survived. Now, this section takes place in Acton. This was the second town that I lived in with my parents. My father had operated laundries in many other small towns in Ontario before my mother and arrived. But my mother and I lived with him only in two of the towns. The first one was Allendale, which is now a part of Barrie, and the second one was Acton. And believe me, it wasn't worth the drive to Acton. Now, though perhaps not everyone here is familiar with the ad, but in Ontario, there's a ad that's called It's Worth the Drive to Acton, and it's because Acton has this store that sells leather goods. But when I was a child growing up in Acton, it was famous for a tannery which tanned leather goods. Okay. The greatest pleasure of those early years in Acton was the Saturday afternoon movie at the Roxy Theatre on Mill Street. I went almost every weekend and sat inside the long auditorium with its curved ceilings, waiting for the lights to go off and for the screen at the front to light up. As the air thickened with the smell of cigarette smoke and buttered popcorn, I laughed at the zany antics of the Three Stooges, did chores on the farm with Ma Pa Kettle, and rode horses through the Wild West with the Lone Ranger and Tonto. The movies taught me that families could be happy and that it was possible for two people to find contentment together. I learned that when a boy and a girl were in love, they held hands, spoke softly, and kissed gently. In fact, everything I needed to know about romance and true love, I discovered at the Roxy Theater. I was determined that I would be like the girls on that big screen, that one day I too would fall in love and get married. In my life, there would be no room for a matchmaker. Under no circumstances would I be like my mother, betrothed at age 3 and married at age 16. I would not sit back and let someone else determine my future for me. I would have a boyfriend, go out on dates. I would laugh with my mouth wide open. Her father, my mother proudly declared, was a modern man. She knew of women from old-fashioned families who were only a few years older than she and had their feet bound. But her father didn't believe in the custom. Instead, he believed in making sure she had an education. My mother told me time and again that according to her father, a full belly was not enough, that his children must be able to read and write. But in spite of his modern ways, my grandfather still felt that it was his duty as a parent to find a suitable husband for her. My grandfather was a herbalist doctor with many rich clients, and he found a match from a particularly wealthy family for his daughter. The boy had been born, according to the local fortune teller, at a time when his stars were compatible with my mother's. Not only that, he grew up to be tall, handsome, and fair-skinned. The world my mother had inhabited as a child, where marriages were arranged and a bride would not meet her husband until her wedding day, felt strange and foreign, but it captivated me. I could see her on the morning of her wedding day, trying to sit still through the hair-combing ceremony and trembling as she put on her red robe. I pictured her being helped into a sedan chair, head bent down at a slight angle, eyes cast down, chest pounding and stomach queasy. As my mother was being carried away from her childhood home, what was she thinking? Was she hoping to live happily ever after? What if her husband was cruel? Did she weep, having to leave her family? When I was younger, I used to think that if I had been in that position, I would have run away. But now I understood that, like my 16-year-old mother, I too would have been immobilized with fear. My mother said to me many times, the moment I stepped out of the wedding sedan chair and peeked through my veil of red silk threads, I felt sick with dread. Why? I asked each time, even when I knew the answer. My husband, she replied, he had the eyes of a snake. Her first husband was tall, handsome, and charming, but lurking behind that ready smile was something sinister. It didn't take long for her to find out the truth about her young husband, that he was already in love, but not with another woman. He was in love with the white powder, with opium. There were some people, my mother said, who could smoke the white powder for occasional pleasure, but that ho-m-ho-lo, that very no-good man, he couldn't live without it. Everything I brought in my dowry, he took and sold. In fear and desperation, my mother hid her wedding gown, the last thing she owned of any value, at the bottom of the rice bin. But he found even that. I imagined my mother, a slender girl bride, sobbing and begging her husband to stop his rampaging as he pushed and shoved furniture, searching for her gown, until he finally kicked over the rice bin, shiny white grains spilling out like a river. I could hear her screaming, "That's mine! That's mine! No!" The moment he uncovered that swatch of bright red silk, I could see her snatching her hidden garment and pressing it to her chest while her husband bent down and pried it away from her fingers. "That's how bad he was," my mother said every time she told the story, her voice coated with disgust. "See what a very no-good person he was. What kind of person would sell his wife's own wedding gown?" My mother always paused and looked at me for agreement, but never waited long enough for an answer. It didn't matter that I had all the right traditions, that for my hair-combing ceremony my father invited a good woman, someone who was prosperous and had lots of sons. It didn't matter that she recited a good luck poem, "First brush makes your marriage strong, second brush makes your lives together long, third brush brings you wealth and many sons to carry on." It didn't matter that my father did all those things. You see, the stars were wrong. There was nothing my father could do about it. The gods had already decided to be unkind, giving me that very no-good man.
Judy, that excerpt, I think, illustrates one of the great beauties of this book, which is the way in which you seamlessly move from time to time, from place to place. We start in a movie theater in Acton. We experience your mother's wedding, your mother's first wedding. And all through the book, we move from modern-day China to China in the past, to Canada in the past. I wondered, when you set out to write this book, was that something that just came seamlessly and effortlessly, or was that something that you really had to work at?
Oh, I wish it did come seamlessly and effortlessly. I find as a writer, I don't know about other writers, but I really have to work at my craft. I think that this was a book that I really did struggle with, because I knew that there were so many time shifts in there, and I was actually very tempted at an early point in the book. I think after the first draft, I thought maybe I should write this as a piece of fiction, because I thought that I had all the elements of fiction, and I thought that if I wrote it as a piece of fiction, I could actually dramatize certain moments, I could make up events, I could make up how people were feeling inside, whereas writing it as a memoir, it's very speculative. But I guess the more I felt about it, I really felt the need to tell the truth and to tell my parents' story and to pay tribute to them. And I think it really helped having gone back to China twice. I think that that gave me an overarching structure.
Now, that's really interesting, because you didn't actually go to China until quite long after both your parents had passed. And I was very curious to know what it was that finally made that decision to go clear for you. Was it something that you had thought about doing all your life and you just had never done, or was it something that you never thought you would actually do?
Oh, it was something that I had been thinking about doing all my life, and I think that I have a lot of excuses, but none of them really very good. I was raising a family, I was deeply in debt, I had a big mortgage, you know, all those sorts of things, but none of them seem like very good excuses in retrospect. And again, I think it's one of those situations where the decision to go back was almost an organic process. It was time.
And when you went back, I mean, one of the most wonderful, magical moments in the book is when you go back to your ancestral village and the entire village comes to greet you and your family, and as if you're, you know, visiting celebrities.
We were celebrities. We were. It wasn't as if. We were.
What was that experience like for you?
It was quite overwhelming. It was really overwhelming from the point of view that everyone knew who I was, even though I didn't know them. Not only did they know who I was, it wasn't a matter of such and such is coming back, such and such is coming back. They knew who I was. They knew who my parents were. They knew about the sister who hadn't come back with us. They knew that she was married to a wealthy professor, and they knew that she lived in a big house. They knew that I lived in a smaller house. They knew all these things. It was astounding.
You were mentioning the speculation in the passage that you read there, putting yourself in your mother's experience and imagining her experience.
Yes.
And I'm just wondering, when you're dealing with your family story, with your mother's story, your father's story, and putting yourself into their lives, their early lives, just that whole experience for you of delving like that, what that was like.
Certainly there were parts of it that broke my heart. There's absolutely no doubt about that. I again, knowing that there probably were moments of tenderness between my parents, because I never saw it. All I ever saw were two quarrelsome people who were bitter, and for them, it seemed that life was over when I look back on it. The bright spot for them always was me. As much as my parents may not have got along with each other, the one thing that I was always sure about as a child was that they loved me. Mm. And I think I probably was truly their one real bright spot.
In the process of writing, were you ever surprised by where you ended up in those deeper places?
Yes. Yes, I was. I really did expect to feel closer to my parents, and the fact that I didn't. And it seemed that the more I wrote about them and the more I fleshed them out, that was a surprise to me, and it was, in a way, a sad surprise.
It seems sort of bearing mentioning, though, that despite the fact that you don't necessarily feel close to your parents, what you do give us in the book, though, is a really vivid sort of 360-degree portrayal of real people that we as the readers get to experience, sort of how you saw them growing up, and then this amazing portraiture of them as you sort of uncover them in China. So,
well, thank you.
So maybe if it wasn't an entirely sort of successful experience, I think this is the challenge of memoir, though, that we're kind of searching for something on a personal level and also on an artistic level as well.
Yes. Well, certainly, I have to admit that even though I was saddened by the fact that my parents grew further away as I got to know them better, I also felt a deep satisfaction upon completion of the memoir, because I really did feel that I had told their story.
There's a really poignant moment in the book towards the end where you have a sort of final dinner with your family, and as you're driving away, your husband asks you, you know, what do you think your father would have thought of that dinner? And of course, raised the question in my mind, what do you think your parents would have thought of the book that you've written?
I think that on one hand, they would have been proud, because my parents loved stories, they loved words, they loved literature, and my father was a man who wrote himself. He actually wrote poetry, and I remember how he would find time to even write verse in the laundry. And I remember once saying to a friend about my father's writing, and I said to him, I don't know how my father ever managed to write poetry. Can you imagine, you know, that he worked so hard? How could he possibly find time? And this friend turned around, and sometimes it does take other people looking at things from another point of view, and he said to me, your father probably survived because he did write poetry. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, maybe there is, you know, something more to that. And so on the one level, I think my parents would have been proud of this as an accomplishment. Whether they would be comfortable with this story being told, that I don't know. I think that might be a totally different issue. Because being a good Chinese girl, which I guess I'm not entirely, having written this book, is that one of the virtues of a good Chinese girl is that you keep your mouth shut, is that you are quiet, you are obedient, and that you do as you are told. And I remember as a child my mother and my father, they had great disdain for women who talk too much. And the women who talk too much were called, in my dialect, hao-diak-a, and that means a many-mouthed bird. So somebody who says, yak-yak-yak-yak-yak. And I feel that there might also be a side of them that feels that this book was a product of a many-mouthed bird.
I'm currently working on a proposal for a writing project, probably about my childhood and my family. You speak about the truth and discovering the truth about family. What would be your advice for me to look into family background?
If your parents are alive and if they're willing, I would talk to them. One of my regrets is that I didn't ask my parents more, that I didn't ask them for their stories. I think that's been a terrible loss, and it's been a particularly poignant loss in my case because my father was so much older and he represented a generation that really isn't around anymore. And I really, in retrospect, realize how privileged I was. So I would talk to your parents.
I am relying on their memory, which may or may not be correct. Say the memories of my siblings, photographs, things like that. But I don't know whether I can get a full picture, or is that not the point?
You don't need a full picture to write a memoir. A memoir is subjective, and it's your truth. It's not their truth. You're not writing a biography of Stephen Harper, where you want to get all the facts right and you want to get the dates right and you want to... Nancy just said, thank God. So it's, you are after truth, and your truth might be quite different from someone else's.
Talking about truth and talking about story, your memoir unfolds like a mystery. There are so many mysteries that come up, so many questions that you delve into and clues that are dropped here and there for you to follow. And so many different perspectives and different ideas of what the real story is or what the truth is. And I'm just love you to talk a bit more about that kind of winnowing out what the truth is for you as opposed to maybe what the truth was for one of your siblings.
When I was talking to my oldest brother here in Canada, my oldest brother in China is dead, but there were some things in the book that I found out in China that he didn't know about. So that was really quite interesting to me. And I must confess that some of the things that I found out in China that are in the book, I'm not even entirely sure that they're totally true, because these people were telling me about things that had happened 70 years ago. And I have a feeling that there might have been some people who were around when those things happened, but they themselves would have been children. They would have been 5 or 6 or maybe 10 at the most, 10, 15 at the most. So how much would they really have known? And so there was this sense of a mythology being passed down. And also I had to kind of match or try to figure out what they told me about my mother. And if I could really picture her doing that.
You mean sort of chasing your father, as they kept saying?
Yes, chasing my father. Yeah, that kept coming up. And there were certain things that when I found out when I was in China, it put a totally different spin on things. For instance, my mother had always led me to believe after she left my father's village that she went to Nanjing to go to school to study about silkworms, and her brother was going to set her up in a business afterwards. And I'd always assumed, or she had led me to believe, that it was a decision on her brother's part to make her an independent woman, to set her up in business, essentially. And then when I found out all these things that happened in the village, it put a totally different spin on it. And I wondered if she was again being rescued from a very tight situation. Mm-hmm. And so there were all those things that just completely changed what I knew.
it really does unfold like a mystery, because there are, with every character that we meet in the memoir, suddenly there's a new piece of information revealed. And one of my favorite parts was the woman in the village who insisted that you were related. And then afterwards, I think it was your niece who was furious that the woman would imply that you were related, because you were absolutely not related.
Yes.
You know, and so that you get little bits of information, and we slowly get to piece it all together like a mystery. I think that's one of the things that makes it really compelling.
Well, that woman, I think, wanted to be related because she wanted a Gold Mountain connection, you know, so that the next time I returned to China, I would look up her family and I would, you know, help them out. I couldn't blame her.
I wonder if you could tell us quickly just one of the stories from your childhood on the sort of way in which in Chinese culture you're sort of named by your relationship to other people around you. And you quickly mentioned how you got your Canadian name.
Oh, my name. The Globe had asked me to write a personal essay, and I didn't know what to write about. And actually what had happened was that I was listening to this CBC, and I was listening to an episode of Definitely Not the Opera, and Sukien Lee was talking about her name and how it was so important to her, and she had other people on the show and they were talking about their names and how a name is of absolute paramount importance. And when she started school, her parents gave her an Anglo name, and I think she went by that Anglo name for a while, and then at some point, I think she was probably about 11 or 12, she very boldly, and I thought quite independently, decided that, nope, she was going to switch back to her Chinese name because that's who she was, and, you know, that was that. And I remember starting to think about that and thinking how I had this kind of really flexible attitude toward my name. And I couldn't help but think if it had to do with the fact that I was Chinese. Because in Chinese culture, traditional Chinese culture, your name isn't really of paramount importance. What is of absolute importance is your title and where you sit within that family constellation. And when I was born, my name was Feng Manliao, and the surname is placed first because it's more important than your given name, because it's the name that belongs to your family, that tells people what group you belong to, that you are a part of the Feng family. And in Chinese culture, the title that you are given tells people where you belong in that family. For instance, I wouldn't call someone just an aunt. The title would imply whether that aunt was on my mother's side or on my father's side, older or younger. And so that's all told in one title. But getting back to Nancy's question, what happened was that I was given the name Fong Munsin, and then when I came to Canada, it was Munsin Fong, because in English culture, it's the given name and then the family name. And when I started school, I was given the name Judy by the lady at the post office, because she told my father I needed a new name for school and that Munsin was far too hard. Nobody would ever remember it. And I think I must have been named after either Judy Garland or Judy Holliday. And so I went to school and I was named Judy, and often there were about three Judys in the class. And whenever the teacher called out Judy, about three of us would put their hands up. And then when I got married, being a fairly conventional sort, I married a man whose last name was Bates, and I became Judy Bates. I also taught at the local school. It was about a 5-minute walk from where I lived. And of course, I was known in the entire neighborhood as Mrs. Bates, Mrs. Bates. I could not walk down our main shopping street without some kid stopping me and calling out Mrs. Bates, Mrs. Bates. Well, I was one of those women who didn't publish their first book till quite late in life, and I was 47. Well, by that time, I was well established as Judy Bates. And so when my book, you know, was about to be published, I really thought seriously, now this is going to be a serious published work. Should it be by Judy Bates, who writes about a Chinese laundry? Who's going to read stories about a Chinese laundry by a woman called Judy Bates? Give me a break. So I thought, well, you know, this is really important, so maybe I should switch back to Judy Fong. And then I thought, well, maybe I should switch back to Munsin Fong. But then my husband, when I started talking to him about this, he just looked crestfallen. you know, as if I was abandoning this name Bates. And so just to show you how truly flexible and probably wishy-washy I am, I couldn't stand up for myself like Sukien Lee, you know, out there saying, no, I'm going to be called this. I said, oh, all right. And so I ended up being called Judy Fong Bates. So here I am. And as I said in my piece, I actually have a notarized letter saying the following person, I think there's Fong Munsin, Munsin Fong, Judy Bates, Judy Fong Bates, Munsin Fong Bates are in fact the same person. So there I am. I answer to them all.
Before we let you go, you had mentioned that you would tell us about the cover of this lovely edition of the book,
Hold
too. Yeah. We have to describe it for radio listeners, too.
This book is especially poignant for me, and it's because the cover shows the fields behind my father's ancestral village in China. It was taken by my husband while we were there on our second trip, and the designer at Random House was especially sensitive, and she took the stamps from the back of my father's head tax certificate and superimposed them on top of the cover. And she even has the creases that are in the head tax certificate superimposed, along with the grommet that was at the top of the certificate. And on the back of the book is my father's picture, which was on his head tax certificate. So it is particularly poignant. Mm.
Judy, thank you so much for being here. It's been such a delight to have you in the book club.
Well, thank you for having me.
That's author Judy Fong Bates in the CBC Radio Studio One Book Club. The Year of Finding Memory is her latest publication, a memoir, and it's published by Random House Canada. Thanks for downloading the North by Northwest podcast.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.